This Amy Oliver Show podcast made possible by Imagine More in Greeley, featuring lighting, cabinets, and home automation. While you're listening to Amy, check them out online at shopimaginemore.com or call them at 330-2888.
I'm really thrilled with my guest in the second hour. He's going to be with me the entire hour, Chris Wright. Chris is the CEO of Liberty Resources, LLC, but that just doesn't say enough. One of the things that I learned last night is some of the things that Chris has done. And really, Chris, when it comes to energy, you have embraced technology regardless of what it is. So, first of all, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here.
Hey, so tell us about some of your, how did you get involved in the energy business and technology? I mean, you seem to be a little bit of a tech geek, but a guy who can talk to normal people.
No, I started out as a science geek. You're generally a science geek before you become a tech geek. I grew up here in Colorado, and of course, I love the outdoors and sports, but maybe most notably a science geek. And really, my original interest was astronomy and the stars and telescopes and how to look at them. And the thing that impressed me most is, the closest star is about 6 trillion miles away, but yet we can see it without a telescope, without binoculars. And I thought, wow, well, that's quite a candle. What's powering that? That began my interest in energy. How do stars last for billions of years, and we can see them from trillions of miles away?
So that kid that grew up loving science and looking at stars, where did you end up going? First of all, where did you go to high school here in Colorado?
I went to high school at Cherry Creek.
Okay.
And at that time, in the early 80s, there was a mania, as there generally is throughout all of history. And the mania then was that we're going to run out of resources very quickly.
God, I remember that. I sat at the kitchen or dining room table. My dad would tell me, you're not going to have oil and gas forever. You're going to have to figure out. We're going to leave it to you guys to figure it out. So I guess that's what you were trying to do.
Exactly. I grew up in that world, and my brother and I were skiers and climbers, and we liked to travel places And you can't go anywhere if we only have 15 years of oil left, and I was 15 years old. So that looked grim for me, and I ended up going to MIT in significant part because of that, because they had a tokamak reactor. Think of a giant donut with badass magnets.
Tokamak? Is that what it's called, literally?
It's called a tokamak. It's like a donut, a hollow donut, where you have a plasma, but mostly just hydrogen gas in different isotopes, and you're trying to get it to very high temperature, and the magnets confine it to try to create fusion, which is what powers the sun and all of the stars. So if we're going to run out of oil and gas, we need something of scale. And so I went to MIT to work on fusion energy.
Okay, so where did that take you? Where did you end up going from there?
Well, I quickly learned I didn't have the patience to be a basic researcher. As anybody knows me and Amy knows me, I don't have a lot of patience. So I loved the idea. I loved seeing the tokamak. I did work briefly on it. And I realized I had a summer job here in Colorado at Honeywell. And after that, I quickly realized I don't want to work in a big company either. I don't want to be a researcher. I don't want to work in a big company. Therefore, I'm going to be an entrepreneur.
Okay, so you then set out. I think you were in California for a while, weren't you?
At MIT, I did an undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering. I went briefly to UC Berkeley for graduate school in electrical engineering, and then I went back to MIT in electrical engineering and worked in power systems. Basically, when you plug your computer, your cord into the wall, and it's got to get down, that's 120 volts alternating current. You got to get 5 volt DC to run your computer. I worked on the problem of how to make those power supplies much smaller. And you can see how small those little power packs are. They were giantly bigger when I was in graduate school. So we worked on a technology to make those smaller.
Okay, so how did that transfer then into the energy industry? Because that's really where you've been for a while. Going back to that initial kid who wanted to see the stars, but heard that you were going to run out of power, you needed to power it so you could continue to see the stars. How did you end up in the energy business?
So in that one semester at Berkeley, I realized I couldn't live on my $850 a month TA salary. I got a consulting job at a tiny company that was building instruments on the surface of the Earth to try to measure what's happening underground, whether it's sliding, does a fault slip before it ruptures, volcanoes, geothermal power. And with those instruments, you also could see hydraulic fractures, which I had no idea what they were at the time. So when I went back to MIT, I kept working for this little company. And it's just through that twist of fate that I ended up developing these technologies further to measure and map both how hydraulic fractures grow. We also monitor volcanoes all around the world and waste disposal and geothermal power. But the focus became, because it was, you know, growing then in the late 80s, early 90s, how to measure and understand what happens underground with hydraulic fractures.
So you end up developing a technology for this. Your business now is still monitoring what happens underground?
It isn't. That company still exists. It employs several hundred people today. But the most significant thing we did was by seeing how fractures actually grow, we came up with some ideas about how to do it a little bit differently. And mostly it was to use less expensive fluids with less chemicals, water, and then try to inject at a higher rate so that instead of creating one fracture underground, we could create a swarm or a network of fractures. And with this larger contact area, now we didn't have to wait till oil and gas leaked out of the shales and floated upwards to get trapped. We could bring this sort of this dense plumbing network right into the source rocks themselves. So we really brought that idea to Mitchell Energy in 97, 98. And so by 2000, I was still running the technology company. I started a shale gas production company called Stroud Energy. And I ran both of those companies till 2006.
And now we have Liberty Resources. Hey, one of the things that I thought was so impressive when I heard you speak last night was what has happened to oil and gas production? This is the thing I think is amazing, because we not just how's the United States positioned now with oil and gas production? And then also, what has used to be, we had heard that there was peak oil. There wasn't any more oil. There wasn't any more oil or gas. We couldn't get any more petroleum-based products out of the resources out of the ground. And you showed some of the most incredible graphs. First of all, talk about where the United States sits in oil and gas production in the world.
So in hydrocarbon production, oil plus gas, the U.S. is now by far and away number one, 25 million barrels of oil equivalent a day. Russia's number two at 20, and Saudi Arabia's number three at 15. So, yes, there's been quite a dramatic surge in United States oil and gas production.
And I think about that because go back to when you were the kid and you were trying to figure out, if we're going to run out of oil and gas, I got to figure out how I'm going to see these stars. And I remember my dad telling me, we're going to run out of oil and gas. It's going to be up to you to figure it out. Yet, and how much were we importing at that time?
So in our imports when I was a kid were just crossing, about to hit 50%. U.S. oil imports peaked at a little over 60% in 2005. And by the end of this year, we'll be down to 25%. For natural gas, we were building in the mid-80s, 2006, 7, 8, we were constructing natural gas import terminals because not only were we importing a lot of oil, but we were going to start importing a lot of natural gas. And ironically, those import terminals right now are the first ones that are being repurposed to export.
Yeah, I was just wondering, are we now going to see those as exports? Well, okay, we have to take a quick break, but coming back, I want to talk about also the increase in production. And one of the other things, too, that you talked about, that because you have this, you've got a significant development in North Dakota and sort of what that has meant to North Dakota. Another thing that you showed, one of the graphs that I thought was, one of the sort of infographics that was so powerful was what has happened to North Dakota per capita income. I mean, I had no idea until I saw that last night, until what you showed us. So I want to share that with folks as well as get into some of the other stuff. And I know you've got a that poverty is sort of your thing. I mean, it's one of those things that you've got a passion for trying to figure out how we can alleviate that. So I want to touch on that as well. Real quickly, Marion Greeley got the answer to our trivia question, which is Joe Nuxel. He was the youngest player in baseball. 15 years old. My guess is his career was short-lived.
Wow.
I know, right? Can you imagine as a 15-year-old having your major league debut?
Not at all.
All right, 17 minutes after 10, talking with Chris Wright, Liberty Resources, LLC. Stay with me here on the Amy Oliver Show. After 10. 10 in the Mountain Time Zone. Welcome back to the Amy Oliver Show, Tuesday, June 10th, 2014. Thanks so much for tuning in. I want to get right back to my conversation with Chris Wright of Liberty Resources. Chris, I'm pretty sure I see you guys driving around up in northern Colorado, or not you, but you have activity. Liberty Resources has activity in northern Colorado. Tell folks what Liberty Resources is.
You've seen those beautiful trucks up there, big white, black, and red. That's actually a second company that I run called Liberty Oilfield Services. And we provide, I originally developed technologies, and now instead of just deploying technology, we deploy the trucks, the pumps, everything, and we execute hydraulic fracture treatments, both for Liberty Resources, but also for two dozen other customers here in Colorado, in Wyoming, and North Dakota.
So when you say Liberty, when I say Liberty Resources, that actually encompasses two sides. Do I have that right? Like one is a technology side, another side is oil field services.
No, sorry about that. The quick end of this story, I started a technology company and a shale gas company.
Sure.
And then in 2006, I sold one and I handed over the reins to the other one. I coached my kids' soccer teams. I traveled to New Guinea twice. I did some bike racing. New Guinea, because of my passion with poverty, we'll come back to that. And I did some other stuff in a pharmaceutical device company, a medical waste disposal company. And it took me a few years to realize nothing is more fun and exciting and I think impactful for the population than energy. So I came back and in 2010 with some partners started Liberty Resources, which is an oil and gas production company using our sort of novel frack technologies. Right now that's operating just in North Dakota. And then 6 months later, we started a hydraulic fracturing services company, Liberty Oilfield Services. Those are the beautiful trucks you see around Greeley and also in Wyoming and also in North Dakota.
Okay, so tell us about North Dakota, because this was pretty exciting. When you were talking about this last night, I was amazed at what has happened in North Dakota. Give us the brief history of North Dakota, economic history of North Dakota, and then your role up there.
So North Dakota, like most rural states, you know, had a very early population peak. The population in North Dakota peaked in 1930, and it's been on a slow decline since then. And when you've got a declining population, there aren't jobs for the kids, there isn't opportunity, and so there's very fabulous, hardworking people up there that are farmers, and they're still there, and the farm and ranch output hasn't changed at all. But in 2006... after 76 years of population decline, North Dakota is the least visited state, so you probably haven't been there.
Right. I don't have a pin from North Dakota.
Yeah.
I have to get one.
And North Dakota in 2006 was 39th in per capita income. And in 2012, 6 years after the shale revolution came to North Dakota, 2012, North Dakota was 7th in per capita income. Has 2.9% unemployment today and a state budget surplus.
Wait, it went from 39th in the nation in per capita income up to, what did you say?
To 7th in 6 years.
Holy smokes. You don't have to be an economist to understand what that does for a population. So, and now they have people coming in, obviously unemployment rate, what is it, about 2.9%?
Yes.
And that's below the sort of natural average.
Yeah. It's the lowest in the country by far. The second lowest unemployment in the country right now is South Dakota, and about fourth lowest is Minnesota. And it's no coincidence those states border North Dakota. So the support industries are booming jobs in the bordering states as well.
You know, but all of this is, you know, all of this is great. But what about some of the problems with hydraulic fracture? And what about, you know, you look at North Dakota, and I've told this to people, you have to take the bad with the good. There's a lot of good that comes from this, but there's also, you know, you have increased traffic. Are they able to keep up with infrastructure? All of that kind of stuff. What has been your personal experience up there? Because you have a development up there.
Yeah, so absolutely very real issues. You know, when you take a state, all of a sudden its population reversed. It's now past its 1930 peak. So the population's growing. The income's growing. You know, there's trucks, there's traffic, there's drilling rigs, there's frack crews. So any rapid growth creates dislocation. So there's no doubt there's some stressed infrastructure there. You know, there's downside as well as upsides. But in North Dakota, probably the most frack-intensive state in the country, they recently did a poll of what percent of the population supports the activity. And, of course, it isn't everyone. In North Dakota, it's only 82% of the people
that
are strongly in favor of what's going on.
the 18% that aren't, still they do have a job and probably appreciate that when you only have 2.9% unemployment. 82% support. So this is and this is a state that has gone rapidly, has made this change pretty rapidly. You also last night suggested, you know, Colorado is headed in that direction.
Colorado's in the early stage of this shale development. There's the main rocks that are being drilled now is the Niobrara Shale, and it's about three times thicker than the Bakken in North Dakota, and below it is a sandstone called the Codell. And so there's much more oil in place per square mile in Colorado, several times as much as there is in North Dakota. So the shale revolution in Colorado could go to tremendous scale as well. Colorado, you know, North Dakota now is over 1 million barrels a day. It's past four OPEC nations in production.
Wait. North Dakota, 1 million barrels a day, past four individual OPEC nations by itself. And I'm not saying little old North Dakota, but one state in the United States produces more than four OPEC nations.
Yes, in the last 6 years, it's passed four OPEC producers in oil production. So it's a big deal. It's a big deal for North Dakota, the surrounding states, and the country. And Colorado is in the early curve of the same thing. Colorado's a little less than 200,000 barrels of oil today. And with just the development plans producers have now, that would exceed 500,000 barrels of oil a day in 4 to 5 years from now. And that would be by no means the end of the growth. But the very large North Dakota effect, the dramatic uplifting of everyone, it started in Colorado, but we're way early. In the next few years, it'll be felt dramatically. Improved schools, increased road infrastructure, county governments in better shape, jobs in the state, right, as unemployment goes down and jobs go up, incomes go up as well. You know, to me, the boom of the energy industry, the important part is not me. We don't need any help or handouts. It's not the people who work in the energy industry. It's the impact of all the industries around us, the support jobs, and most importantly, the benefit of low-cost energy is enormously impactful to a society, to a state, and particularly to lower-income folks.
And, you know, one of the things we found when we were doing a study of just looking at states that produce most of its own energy, the largest energy-producing states, interestingly enough, have also some of the lower energy prices. I mean, you just see that. We actually thought it might low energy prices might correlate to elected PUC commissioners. Actually, the correlation really is when we went through everything was that states that produce their own energy tend to or produce more energy per capita tend to have lower energy costs. And so I think about that for states. Well, of course, that would mean that then for the United States versus the rest of the world. And if we don't have to import all of this, then we can produce, we're energy independent.
Yes, the energy independence sort of a balance of trade thing that we produce it here with our jobs and our people versus overseas. But the other very important point you make, Amy, is the differential prices. Let me give a few examples of that. In Colorado, the price to heat your home, your natural gas bill, it's 40% lower than in New England because the gas is here. It's right here in the pipelines. To transport it and store it further away, prices start to go up. Natural gas prices in the U.S. are roughly three times lower than in Europe, China, Japan, and all of our manufacturing competitors. So just a tremendous manufacturing cost advantage for the U.S. And even oil. We think oil is a global market. It's easier to ship and transport than natural gas. But the United States oil prices are roughly 10% lower than the rest of the world because there's so much oil within the U.S. versus crude traded on carriers. That 10% differential in oil prices in the U.S. is $70 billion a year in savings to the United States. The natural gas price differential is about $150 billion a year in savings. So if you do the math, it's roughly $1,500 per family in lower energy costs in the U.S. versus Europe and other industrialized countries.
So think about that, everyone. $1,500 for a family, I'm guessing family of four. Think of what you do with that. You know, we're talking about school supplies, kids' shoes. We're talking about groceries, your grocery. I mean, That is an enormous amount of money when you think about it for the average American family.
That last point you say is the key. To me, if you're an investment banker, you're a Hollywood movie star, you don't notice $1,500 a year cheaper. You know?
Yeah, you spend that on a bottle of wine at times.
Right, but to lower-income Americans, it's enormously impactful. This makes the difference in a family vacation and kids doing more things and just lower stress in life. And, of course, there's still a great amount of stress. I don't want to belittle the struggles of lower income in this country, but this has been a massive benefit. The U.S. government has a program called Low-Income Help for Energy Program.
Low-Income Assistance Program, it's LEAP, I think.
LEAP, yes. So this is to help pay energy bills for low-income people, and it puts out about $3.5 billion a year to low-income families to help them pay energy bills, and that's fantastic. Three times bigger than LEAP, about $11 billion a year, is just the market price savings of those same families buying gas since the shale revolution started compared to 8-10 years ago before the shale revolution was of scale.
And we have to take a break, but I want people to think about this too. The fact that we also don't have a dictator controlling whether or not gas is even being supplied to our country, regardless of cost, might shut off the valve just because he wants to. Imagine that in the middle of the dead cold of winter, Colorado, and it's 0 degrees, and you've got a wind chill outside, and you had somebody who decides to shut off your supply of natural gas, where you'd literally sell anything in your house practically just to get that supply back. We don't have to do that with this shale revolution.
Fantastic. I agree entirely.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Coming back, we're talking a little bit about the environment and poverty, which is one of Chris's big things. Traveled the world and has seen really poverty that we probably don't even know in this country. Truly what poverty looks like. And, you know, there's actually a way to solve it, and that's to bring affordable power to millions billions of people across the planet. 34 minutes after 10, let's check in at the 24-Hour News and Weather Center. Minutes after 10 on the Amy Oliver Show, Tuesday, June 10th, 2014. Thanks for tuning in to 1310 KFKA. Brady and Jason, Agfinity Sports Day up shortly. In the meantime, we are talking with Chris Wright of Liberty Resources. And you know what? You and I have chatted during the break. I don't even remember where we laid off or where we left off. I think we're going to talk about the environment or something.
Let's finish poverty,
and then
we're absolutely going to move on to the environment.
I get so enthralled in what you're saying, I forget where I need to go next.
And this, you know, as they say, I was a science buff and a history buff, really. And these kind of evolved most everything I've done in my life. But if you look back in time, you know, we'll first look at today. The energy matters. Afghanistan, Haiti, Republic of the Congo, these are the lowest per capita consumers of energy in the world. The highest per capita consumers of energy, number one, is Iceland. You've also got Norway, Canada, and U.S. at the top. So that accessibility to energy changed the world. And it originally changed the world in a large scale about 1,000 years ago. So when feudalism was in full force, about 90% of the people worked on farms just to grow enough food. People were calorie deficient. Of course, the average full-grown male was less than 5 feet tall. And a great energy innovation came along called the horse. And when we switched from oxen to horse pulling plows in agriculture, horses can put out twice as much energy for the same calorie consumption through eating hay or oats or whatever. So now we had this enormous explosion in the availability of energy, which drove up farm productivity and was a major catalyst for the ending of feudalism. Then jump ahead a few hundred years, and now we have property rights institutions developing in England you know, starting from Magna Carta, but going through the Glorious Revolution. And when we start to get true free market property rights, the biggest jump here, obviously Adam Smith's ideas in 1776, but they don't really get implemented till the 1840s. I call the 1840s the decade that changed everything. And this is when the British Parliament passed a law called the Registration Act. It was the same year as the Stamp Act, which is the famous one. Bigger was the Registration Act, which allowed you, Amy and I, and whoever else to start a company. As long as we comply with the laws, we can file our papers and form a corporation. Until 1842, you need a majority vote of Parliament to form a company in the Great Britain. And in the United States, you needed a majority vote of the state legislature to form a company. Whichever state you're in.
I had no idea. I had no idea about that.
This is the decade that changed everything. This will be realized more and more coming forward in the next few decades. If you look at human life expectancy and just size and calorie consumption, they moved forward from the time of the pyramids to about 1840, maybe a three-time increase in purchasing power adjusted income, how well off people were. But people in 1840 in the U.S., who was now one of the wealthiest countries in the world, the average height of an American male, full grown, was about 5 feet tall, and our life expectancy was 40 years. So that's when we changed the state constitutions in this country. There they called them corporation acts that allowed people to form companies without a vote of the state legislature. Now business and commerce thrived. Since then, from 1840 to today, we've had a 25-fold increase in per capita income, purchasing power, so not adjusted for inflation, and life expectancy went from 40 years to 80 years. So commerce, free markets, and property rights changed the world. And it's no coincidence. These things happened in the 1840s. The oil and gas industry started in 1959. The first well drilled in Titusville, Pennsylvania. 1859. So when you have booming commerce, you've got to have energy. You've got to have low-cost energy to make it happen.
So we see the access to affordable power, what it has done to the United States. You mentioned a couple of countries. You mentioned Haiti. You mentioned Afghanistan. I would throw, you know, North Korea, places like that, places that don't have access to affordable power or places where government controls access to affordable power. What do they look like?
So, yeah, so here is and the most simplest one to talk about. I'll talk about one island, the island of Hispaniola. It's where Christopher Columbus landed when he first got here. The island of Hispaniola today is two countries. On the eastern side, it's the Dominican Republic. On the western side, it's Haiti. And if you look at a satellite photo, Haiti is brown, scorched and dark. I mean, and bright, because in Haiti, they don't have property rights, they don't have hydrocarbons, so they cut down the trees and they burn grass for energy source. The Dominican Republic developed hydrocarbon import, distribution, infrastructure. It's a lush forest. It's a beautiful place. The per capita income several times higher. The life expectancy is much longer. My other passion besides poverty is the environment. I'm a longtime board member of a great free market environmental group called PERC, Property and Environment Research Center. I'm a mountain climber and adventurer. So, of course,
you're a cyclist.
I'm a bike racer. So I care about, you know, selfishly, I love the outdoors. Obviously, everybody loves clean water and clean air and to breathe well. So the environment is another passion of mine. And when you in my search after poverty, which means you go to poor areas, which generally means third world countries, there you see not only does hydrocarbons create much, you know, better human conditions, but it's also enormously positive for the environment. If you're cutting down trees and grass and you burn grass inside for heating, you have 3 million people a year die just from particulate pollution from breathing indoor smoke, and your impact on the environment is massive. When they get kerosene, heating oil, and coal to these countries, the environment rebounds, people rebound. Remember as well, my last history point, that the industry that saved the whales is the oil and gas industry. When we drilled that oil well in 1859 and the oil industry developed, that is when the whale population bottomed a few years after that and started to recover. Because killing whales was our source of lamp oil.
Now, you're in the oil and gas business, but you keep saying hydrocarbons, and then you also just mentioned coal. I thought you guys were supposed to hate coal.
Not at all. Not at all. No, of course, in the U.S., The switch to natural gas for electricity, it's driven our CO2 emissions down dramatically, more than any major nation. In fact, the per capita emissions in the U.S. right now are lower than any year since I was born. So yes, and of course, coal emits particulate pollution and emits some mercury and SOx and NOx. Natural gas is much cleaner than coal, and it certainly had a great positive impact in the U.S., the shift there. I want a market shift, and I want tight regulations to reduce particulate emissions, but I'm not at all against coal, because in the rest of the world, we've had about a billion people lifted out of poverty over the last 20 years, mostly through property rights innovations. But another major enabler of that has been the surge in coal use worldwide, and bringing electricity and heating and lighting to poor people that were before burning wood, dung, and grass inside huts. Yeah. So coal has been enormous in lifting up the quality of life of people.
Number one form of pollution is, or that leading cause of death for, if your pollution related death is indoor air pollution.
Yes.
I saw that recently. But here's my question. Why is it that we're made to feel guilty about this, about affordable power, instead of blessed by it?
It's funny. I grew up in the same time as you did as well, and I learned from very early on that the oil industry was bad and hydrocarbons were dirty. And remember, I went to study to work on fusion energy. The first thing I worked after fusion was solar power. I've worked in geothermal power, energy efficiency. So it took me a while. It took me quite a while, really, on this quest for looking at trying to understand poverty, to understand how enormously impactful to humans and how enormously helpful to the environment hydrocarbons have been. Now, are they perfect? Of course not. Is everything perfect? You know, does a car emit exhaust and it dirties the air? Of course. All human activity impacts the environment. The biggest one by far being the invention of agriculture. But if you look at the evolution of hydrocarbons, cleaner burning engines, more, you know, now we have combined cycle power plants with natural gas with very high thermal conversion efficiencies. And huge to me as a sort of an outdoor enthusiast and an environment is the impact on the surface of the earth. We used to use maybe 10 to 20% of the land in an oil field. Today, it's less than 1% of the land, because we drill these wells down and turn them right, and they go a mile or two out. So now we can drain hydrocarbons from these low-perm shale rocks, which are below conventional production. So it's cleaner production than conventional oil and gas production, and a dramatically reduced footprint on the surface.
Right.
I'm very proud of that fact.
We have to take a quick break. Coming back, we'll have a few minutes left. I do want to touch on the environment, because all this stuff sounds great, but you know, you still have people out there saying you're poisoning children, and so who cares if your GDP is going up if you're killing kids? So I want you to address that coming back. 10:47 the time. I'm Amy Oliver, talking with Chris Wright of Liberty Resources. If you've missed any of this, don't worry. It'll be available on podcast at 1310kfk.com. We'll be back in just a moment. About 5 minutes left in the second and final hour of the Amy Oliver Show. Boys of Agfinity Sports Day up next. I want to get right back to Chris Wright, Liberty Resources. Chris, you know, okay, so all of this stuff we've been talking about, how great the development of hydrocarbons has been. We can tell that it has raised people out of poverty. It has obviously increased our calorie consumption, so therefore we grow taller, we grow stronger, we live longer, we live healthier, we live better. We feel good about that, but you're poisoning children. So how can that be a good thing? I mean, you're killing the environment and poisoning children. You're evil.
That would offset it, of course, if it was true. And there is a common view of that, which is the real issue. And I guess I apologize for rambling, and we're getting to it so late. But if I'm a farmer in eastern Colorado, or I live in a subdivision, and all of a sudden a giant drilling rig shows out at my back door with a bunch of clanking iron and big burly guys, and is going to loudly drill a hole under the ground and then inject stuff that they're not going to tell me what it is underground where my groundwater is, I would be furious too. I would be alarmed. I'd want to know what's going on. So I very much sympathize with the concerns people have. I would have them too if I wasn't in the industry. And I think our industry's done a terrible job. You know, historically, as I said, when we were kids, the oil and gas industry is the bad guys. So what's their response to that? Oh, let's keep our head down. Hopefully nobody notices us. And then,
Nobody notices the thousands of wells.
Traditional oil field places, you know, that sort of work because the people are familiar with it. Shale revolution allowed us to produce oil and gas out of rocks we couldn't before. So now drilling rigs are going places they weren't drilling before. That's the big change. So now people, they've never seen it before, and our industry just terrible, terrible at PR and communicating openly and candidly with everyone. So I fault ourselves for that. And all of us in the industry, together we meet now and talk often. We need to be out there, open and honest about what's talking about. But regarding polluting children, of course, nothing of the sort. I have children. You have children. I'd be outraged and ashamed and would participate in nothing of the sort. The great thing about oil and gas production, as I said, is particularly the shale revolution. We do a lot of